Yeah, let's do it.
It doesn't take too much to get into character anymore, does it? You know.
Well, I've ceased to be able to tell what's the character and what's not. I feel like I'm in character all the time. I've just become the podcaster.
I'm enjoying a nice iced coffee that I just got at Balzac's. They're not even paying me for this promo. I just believe in the product so much.
All right, well, shall we get into it? We've got another superdelegate Q&A. This one also coming a little late. We should probably catch up next month, or rather this month, since I believe this was May's.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you guys had all these podcasts to do all the time, you would get a little tired too. But hey... I love doing these Superdelegate Q&A episodes. Even though we procrastinate on them, I love doing these because it leads us to consider things that we might not otherwise consider, talk about things we might not otherwise talk about. For example, the first question here is from Ian, who asks, "Happy Pride Month. What's a dumb thing you have done or not done out of fear of being called gay?" Luke, why don't you start?
Well, I'll just say that since, I don't know, round about 2018, I've spent an inordinate amount of time in the gym, an inordinate amount of time accruing a giant reserve of exotic knowledge about different bodybuilders and, you know, different hunky actors. I know a lot about Henry Cavill's workout routine that he did for Batman versus Superman, that kind of thing. And, you know, by way of answering the question, I just say make of all that what you will.
As for me, I've logged a lot of gay porn on Letterboxd over the years. And people always seem to think that's strange, but what can I tell you? I love all genres of cinema.
I mean, I have, like, you know, I have known you for a long time now. We have spoken to one another about many subjects, and I was saying to you just the other day when we were looking around at your Criterion closet or whatever, and you just have like shelves of porn of all kinds, like mostly like vintage and yeah, like lots of gay porn.
Shelves too, to be clear. It's a tiny fraction of what's in there, but yes, there is the erotica section.
That's it. Yeah. yeah. And I mean, I was saying to you, like how do you watch this? You just sit there and you watch it like you would a movie. your ability to watch it as like a scholar is like remarkable.
I would
to
just
me.
Say, watch Wakefield Pool's Bijou. Watch Arthur J. Bresson's Passing Strangers. I think they speak for themselves. They're beautiful films. Daniel says, "Luke and Will, your insights on art and politics and mass media have an impact that match their depth, profoundly changing the worldview of your listeners and opening them up to new ideas and the hope for a better future. Can you please weigh in on the Kendrick Lamar Drake feud? More specifically, as maybe the city's biggest cultural export, how was Drake seen and treated by Torontonians before it started? Can you speak to how he was seen by the Black community specifically versus the wider population? What's the perception of Drake there now? Is there any defensiveness around him?" Well, I don't think we can really speak for the Black community. What we can speak to the place he occupied in Toronto's branding, let's call it, you know, 8 or 10 years ago, which was pretty big. I think you'll agree, Luke. Drake was pretty inescapable in Toronto, like in the mid-2010s, just as a cultural ambassador.
Yeah, you know what? Forget the Kendrick Lamar Drake feud. Give me the Norm Kelly Drake bromance. That's what it's all about. One of the greatest moments in Toronto's cultural history, in my opinion.
And I would say that Drake is perceived in Toronto right now basically the same way he's perceived everywhere else. Make of that what you will.
I don't know. He's really famous. I don't know. I think in Toronto, you know, he's still kind of an institution. But yeah, I don't know. You're kind of asking the wrong guys here. I don't really have much of an opinion about this. Jackson asks, "I know this topic has come up a lot, but nonetheless, I remain curious. At this point, what is the relationship of Michael Moore and his films to the podcast? Is the Michael in your podcast name vestigial? Or is there still some meaning signification?" What do you think, Will? It's kind of a deep question, kind of an existential question.
Michael is the root. Michael Moore is the sun. Michael Moore is the nucleus around which everything orbits. Our perspective, our political awakening stems for Michael Moore. And even though he doesn't come up all that often, he is deep-seated. That's what I would say his relationship to the pod is.
That's right. At the height of the Roman Empire, you know, Romulus had been dead for probably 700 years. And, you know, people probably didn't talk about him all that much. But does that mean that Romulus wasn't the founder of Rome? Give me a break. Casey says, what is a deeply held belief you've changed your mind about? For me, I think this one's easy. I mean, the extent to which this was a deeply held belief, I don't know, because it was one that I developed. It was formed in adolescence and kind of held throughout my early 20s. But the kind of, you know, atheist streak that I had when I was like in my late teens, you know, early 20s, you know, you're reading The God Delusion, you're reading God Is Not Great, that kind of stuff. I really did for some years think that it was an intellectually complete picture of the world to just sort of say like, oh, well, if you believe in this, then wouldn't you also have to believe in the flying spaghetti monster? You haven't seen that either. Blah, 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 blah. And yeah, I went from that to writing what might have been the most viral article attacking the new atheist movement. So yeah, that's what it would be for me.
I'm tempted to answer this by saying that believing in God is probably the biggest deeply held belief I've changed my mind about. But again, I do think believing in God just as a child and a teenager wasn't a particularly deeply held thing. I think it was just sort of part of the furniture where I grew up. It's something that I was never particularly invested in and that was pretty paper thin and crumbled fairly easily once I left the nest. So our more real answer, which is also a vaguer answer, would be I'm just less dogmatic about a lot of things. I think I'm more dogmatic about the things that matter, but I'm less dogmatic about, I don't know, many matters of art and culture. I'm more empathetic, more open-minded about all sorts of things, because I think when you're younger, you're very busy trying to like define your taste, define your worldview, be for things and be against other things. I've maybe got a little more dogmatic in my politics, but less so in how I view art, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. Katarina asks, the recent Studio 60 episodes have been delightful. Well, thank you. We're having a good time with them. Moreover, they somehow brought back the scintillating glee of the early Michael Moore-focused episodes. What is the relationship between Sorkin and Moore in your minds? Why do these two figures seem to strike such a similar cultural note despite different ideological proclivities? That's interesting. What do you make of this one, Will?
I think they were both part of a particular time during the Bush era, especially. I mean, obviously, both of them predate the Bush era, but they hit a sort of stride in the Bush era when the Bush era was a real birth of that, like, the facts will save us kind of approach to discourse. I don't think Michael Moore and Aaron Sorkin are like the same person at all. I like Michael Moore a lot more. But the way that Fahrenheit 9/11 was received at the time as a sort of like, oh, we got to get the information from this movie out there and then people will see, sort of reminds me of certain tendencies in Aaron Sorkin's work and in a lot of liberal culture of that era.
Maybe. I take your point there, Will, but by way of you know, defending the Romulus of our show, Mr. Michael Moore, if we think about his filmmaking efforts in the 2000s, you know, particularly something like Fahrenheit 9/11, where he was really trying to he was trying to swing an election. And I mean, he didn't succeed in doing that. You know, there's no way of measuring what impact on the 2004 election that film had. But I mean, as you and I have endlessly talked about, you know, he was someone, and that film was something that supporters of George Bush, many of them, regarded as a very real threat. Like, they were terrified of that. And just the nature of the effort, where Moore is intervening with that movie, with something like that movie, has done this in a number of places. You know, Sicko is probably, you know, the other really, really strong example. He is trying to intervene. He's trying to change minds. And often there is some kind of programmatic thing at the end, whether it's affecting an electoral outcome or winning the battle for socialized medicine in the United States, right? You contrast that to Aaron Sorkin, whose worldview, and, you know, it's especially striking with Sorkin because he's not making documentaries, right? He's making fantasies, right? So you get to see inside, like, what would the ideal Democratic presidential administration be like if the smart people were there and not the fucking rubes and blah, blah, blah. And they still don't do anything. right? They don't pass. They don't pass socialized medicine or a public option. They don't pass significant legislation of any real kind, except for the thing where they do a closed door secret deal to cut Social Security. The newsroom, same thing. It's like, oh, well, if there was like a guy doing an epic news face all the time, we could have covered the Tea Party, right? And it doesn't make any difference. So I guess, Will, is sort of a friendly amendment to what you said, because while I think these two figures have sometimes played footsies, or rather Moore has played footsies with certain ideas that I'm not really in sympathy with, I think are kind of wrong-headed when it comes to, winning with the facts or, whatever it is. I do think he takes Democratic persuasion much more seriously. And I do think, needless to say, the things he's aspiring to are much more concrete, real, and laudable than like what Aaron Sorkin does. Aaron Sorkin just wants to own people with logic and feel smug about it.
Yeah, in case it wasn't clear, I'm much more struck by the differences between the two figures than the similarities. Christian asks, is Woody Allen funny? I know Will is a big fan of Allen, and I'd like to know whether he thinks the humor of his golden age, up to, say, Bullets Over Broadway, still holds up, and what, if any, principles of humor are evident in Allen's writing, apart from If It Bends. The second question, what principles are evident in Allen's writing, is interesting. Is he funny? I mean, I think that depends on the movie. It depends on the piece. I find his New Yorker humor articles, the essays that are collected in Without Feathers and Getting Even and those books, I find them more kind of like pleasant than funny these days. They don't really make me laugh out loud. I mean, I don't know. I think there are a lot of funny scenes in those early movies, like in Take the Money and Run when he's in the marching band and he plays the cello, or a lot of funny scenes in Annie Hall, for instance. So I don't know, just as a matter of personal taste, I think he's very funny in that Golden Age run. What do you think, Luke? Funny?
Yeah, I think he's funny. You should watch, forget everything Will was just talking about, you should watch his great movies. You should check out Rifkin's Festival, one of the funniest things I've ever seen. I've seen it twice, laughed my fucking ass off both times. Also, what's the one with Jason Biggs? Anything else?
Very, very good film.
But as anti-comedy, those films are unmatched. But no, if we're being serious, I think you like those really early comedies, maybe a little more than me. I think, Bananas and Sleeper are, okay. I've only seen each of them once. The first of those early comedies, I guess, is really like the last in that kind of run. But the one that really like first did anything for me was Love and Death, which is kind of the, satire of Russian literature.
That's a top five Woody for me, easily.
It's great. It's really, really funny. And some of the stuff like, what's that stand-up thing he had, like The Moose? I think The Moose is pretty funny.
Yeah, I like his stand-up. His stand-up's good. But as to any principles of humor evident in his writing, I'm more struck by just the principles of his thought in general. Like if you were to boil down his entire career to one idea, I frankly think it's the heart wants what it wants. Like, you look at all those movies from Hannah and Her Sisters to Vicky Cristina Barcelona to Rifkin's Festival, and so many of them are about you can't control how you feel, you can't control who you fall in love with. Yeah, the heart wants what it wants. That's a central dilemma in his work. And, you see in his personal life the potential dark side of that dilemma. But I also think you can't really deny that it's a compelling human dilemma. So as to principles of comedy, I'm having trouble off the top of my head, like pinpointing them. But just broader principles, I think it's that. Michael says, if you could introduce one law as national leader of Canada, what would it be?
Well, I'm finding with these Q&A episodes, there's always inside you, there are two wolves. One of them wants to make a joke and the other wants to, like, one wants to riff, the other wants to offer a serious answer. I think I'll do the latter. I don't know, just off the top of my head, since I don't think I've talked about it on the show before, one of my favorite ideas that Ed Broadbent ever had, something I loved talking about with him, something I'm just overjoyed we got into the book, was Ed was very interested when he got into politics in ideas about industrial democracy. And he had a proposal that he published in a number of places. I think it was submitted as a resolution to one of the NDP conventions in the late 60s, early 70s, something like that. And essentially, the idea was to reform labor law, to reform property law as well in Canada, such that, first of all, every single workplace with more than 50 employees is automatically a union local. Okay, so you don't need a union drive. As Ed put it, you know, just as citizens exist where nations exist, unions should exist where workers exist. Pretty damn good. But that was only part one. It gets better. My favorite part was actually his idea that we should expand the sort of pool of things that workers can bargain for, such that they're not only bargaining for wages and working conditions, they're also bargaining for the prerogatives of management. So workers at the bargaining table, you know, a massively empowered, you know, Canadian workforce at the bargaining table is able now to not just demand or strike if necessary for wages and working conditions. They're able to demand more information about how a firm is run. They're able to demand ownership rights in that firm. They're able to, you know, increasingly exercise power in the actual kind of executive functioning of firms, the major business decisions, stuff like when new technology or new processes are introduced. I think that would be pretty cool, and it would be interesting to see. I mean, this would overturn like 300 years of sort of like a legal framework based on the classical liberal idea of property rights. But, you know, sometimes you just got to go hard.
My mentor says, I've been loving the Sorkin content of late, which got me thinking. Much as Beethoven's 10th was hypothetically composed by a scholar of his work, I'd ask Luke specifically, as one of North America's preeminent Sorkinologists, to speculate, if Studio 60 was recommissioned for a belated second season in 2024, what would it look like? How would Aaron Sorkin mine the smart laughs at the expense of Donald Trump? What if 19th century comic opera would be parodied to do social justice commentary concerning reproductive rights? Is Juliet Lewis still a relevant target for ridicule?
There are so many interesting facets to this. So, I mean, to sort of deal with it in reverse order, the Juliet Lewis question is interesting because part of me wants to say he would still have like a fatwa out for Juliet Lewis. You know what I mean? Like, there's something about his demonology of Juliet Lewis runs so deep. But then I also think maybe he would just kind of substitute a different actress that he like needlessly hates, but it would still be a very dated reference. Like he would substitute like Mina Suvari or something. you know what I mean? Yeah. Like because his reference points are always out of date. Maybe he would update it very slightly, but it would be one of those two things. In terms of which 19th century comic opera, I think that would all remain static. So it would still be fucking, you know, Gilbert and Sullivan and shit like that. But to the kind of the meat of this question, it is actually very interesting because, you know, this is something, again, where you can just like riff and have fun in trying to answer. But I do actually think it gets to some deep questions of ideology when it comes to Sorkin, you know, deep questions about his method and how he interprets the world. I think that if, you know, Studio 60 was made now, or let's say if there was a second season about it, I think largely it would probably remain the same. Like the fundamental contours wouldn't have shifted. But one thing I do know, and one thing that I think would be very different, is that there would be a ton of stuff about like social media and bots and like all that stuff that's kind of in the background of Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, you know, where there's the stuff about, you know, ain'titcoolnews.com and shit like that. That would just be like 80% of the show, I think. Like, there'd be a ton of stuff about social media, misinformation, and all the dumb rubes on Facebook, and, you know, there'd probably be, I mean, if it was specifically made now, like, he'd still be incensed about, like, vaccine denialism. Oh, also, there would be a whole episode dedicated to, like, the idea that some stand-in for Joe Rogan, or maybe just Joe Rogan, is, like, as bad or worse than Donald Trump, you know, as corrosive or more corrosive than Donald Trump.
I think it would be interesting to see the episode about Israel-Palestine, because you know there would be one. You know that Aaron Sorkin right
well,
now...
Well, there is one. He did one for The West Wing.
But for this show, Studio 60, you know that that Aaron Sorkin right now is probably very perturbed by all the campus protests. I think there would be a really mealy-mouthed both sides episode about how, actually, a comedy has no place in this. So leave us alone. Dustin asks a provocative question. What is the minimum threshold where political violence is justified? Well, I don't pretend to know the answer to that. What I would say about political violence is the one principle I have for sure on this is the targeting of civilians is wrong.
Yeah, well, I don't really feel like I can answer this question directly in detail because it's too abstract. Like, in order to answer it, like you have to, in order to answer it concretely, you would have to sort of bring it down to the level of reality. And you know, it'd be very context specific. I think the question that's sort of more often relevant in history, I don't know, is like the extent to which political violence is useful or has ever been useful in achieving political ends. I mean, I suppose it also completely depends on what you mean by political violence. You know, there's the famous, Clausewitz quote. I think it's Clausewitz, right? War is politics by other means. And I mean, people have been using wars for thousands of years to redraw maps and create states and destroy them. And so, you know, the political violence in that sense has, you know, a very long,
It's very easy to get kind of lost in a question of like, well, what is violence? Is capitalism violence? Is this or that? Violence. So it's a difficult question to answer without, getting lost down a rabbit hole.
Yeah, the only thing I have useful to say about this is, and I know this won't be very very satisfying to Dustin, the listener who asked it, is I think often the more urgent question and the one that I find most interesting in thinking about particular historical events is, you know, yeah, is political violence justified? But like more so, when is it actually useful or when has it been useful to achieve ends that are moral or ethical? Not a great answer, but also very much a how much time you got kind of question. So, you know.
Well, shifting gears on this next question, which actually isn't a question, Eric the Bed Humper says you have a butt that just won't quit, Luke. What do you think of that? Not bad, huh? It's a nice compliment from Eric. You've been doing squats?
Deadlifts. Bulgarian split squats of late. Sumo deadlifts, leg press.
Good stuff.
And, you know, 0.8 to 1.3 grams of protein per pound of body weight every day, folks. That's how it's done.
This is another question from Dry Butt Plug. I don't think that's his real name, but nevertheless, Dry Butt Plug asks, oh, I like this question. Thoughts on Wings? I assume he's talking about the Paul McCartney band, right? They have some good songs, huh? I mean, Live and Let Die, I kind of like that one.
I was listening to the album that Paul and Linda McCartney made. I think it was his second, like it came after the eponymous McCartney album. This one was Ram, and I like Ram better than I like any Wings album. I mean, Band on the Run is, you know, it's fun, but it's kind of slight. I actually like McCartney's first album, even though there are a few things where I feel like he's not trying as hard as, like, do you know McCartney's first album, the one that's just called McCartney?
I know I've listened to it, but I don't really remember it.
So it's fun and it's got some good songs. It's got Every Night, Maybe I'm Amazed, Junk, good song. But then he does this lazy thing where, like, on the B side of the album, there's a song that's just called Sing Along Junk, and I swear to God, it's just the instrumental. Like, it's just the guitar from the song Junk, and now you can sing along, which to me is a little gimmicky. He did play every instrument on it, and I think the same is true of Ram. They have a kind of, like, fun homemade quality, and they're, like, a reminder that McCartney, he's a really, like, just one of the most instinctively gifted pop musicians that is, like, ever, like, that has ever existed. But yeah, I think he's better in kind of that context. Like, I like, yeah, the more minimalist kind of homemade stuff, I think, more than I like Wings. Though I agree, there's some fun songs.
Shifting gears again, a pretty heavy question from James. Given it seems to be the perennial concern of our times, I'll ask a question again re the current Palestinian genocide, and specifically the Canadian reactions to it. I could sense, from friends in Toronto and elsewhere, a sense of hope with Olivia Chow and her independent win. That's Olivia Chow is our current mayor in Toronto. Only for this hope to be squandered by her condemnations of anti-apartheid protests, among other things. How has this left you two feeling in the time since her election as mayor of Toronto?
Well, I actually would politely depart, at least somewhat, from the spirit of the question. I mean, Yeah, it goes without saying there have been a number of statements issued by the mayor's office about various protests. I mean, the one on the one that was on University Avenue with like the guy dressed as Spider-Man getting up on the hospital or whatever.
In front of Mount Sinai Hospital, you know, one of those classic cases, not even worth getting into.
Anyway, yeah, I think we talked about it a while back. But I would also say, I mean, Olivia Chow was, I believe, the first big city mayor in North America to call for a ceasefire. She wrote an op-ed in the Toronto Star, biggest circulation newspaper in Canada, in which she took aim at the use of starvation as a tool of war. Her administration's also done a lot of good work in the, I think this is the 1 year anniversary of her election. Particularly on homelessness, you know, right away she made homelessness a priority. I think this is like a pretty rare thing for a mayor of a city like Toronto to do. She's been very clear. We have a housing crisis. She's last summer was picking fights with the federal government over it, shaking them down for more money to open new shelter spaces, you know, particularly for many of the refugees in Toronto who are living on the streets. Yeah, an end to the encampment clearings, things like that. So I'm very happy about all of that. And I think it is miles difference from what we would have gotten with our previous mayor, who up until, I don't know, a year and a half ago, it just seemed like we were going to have Bay Street Tory, you know, center right governance for like, you know, the next 15 to 20 years. And then even when John Tory left, he was just going to have like a handpicked successor. I mean, that's kind of what it seemed. So I'm actually still feeling reasonably good about things.
Michael asks a question for me. Do you have any recommendations for any film criticism books about Taiwan cinema? I'm thinking specifically about Edward Yang, who I recently discovered in my local cinema here in Rotterdam. Well, one book about Taiwanese cinema that I've used and that I like is called Taiwan Film Directors, A Treasure Island by Emily Yua Ye and Daryl William Davis. To Edward Yang, I don't have any recommendations for books about him, unfortunately. I like, there's a good Richard Suchensky book about Ho Xiao Shen that I would recommend. But I'm also in the market for recommendations of books about Taiwanese cinema, particularly if anybody knows any books about sort of Taiwanese pop cinema. A lot's been written about the art house films that came out of there. But I don't know, has anything been written about Two Lins and a Chin, or the Taiwan Black movies, or, you know, just some of the weird exploitation-y stuff? Phones are open.
You know, this is making me think, like, what Asian cinema have we done? We've done some, you know, Kurosawa, Ozu. We did Uncle Boonmi, Who Can Recall His Past Lives. That was a beautiful film. Very, very pleased you introduced me to that one. But we should do, like, let's do some Wong Kar Wai. Yeah. Let's do In the Mood for Love or something like that. Chungking Express. Let's watch Hard Boiled, just because it would be fun and talk about it.
I just watched Hard Boiled again last week. They played it at the Paradise Cinema, so I saw it
God
again.
God damn it, man. Yeah. Well, Matthew asks, maybe an unusual guest recommendation, but I would love to hear you guys chat with Todd McGowan, the UVM professor of film studies. Are you familiar with him? Yes, I'm familiar with him. I love his book on David Lynch. He has a podcast called Why Theory and is a psychoanalytic film theorist. He has a good sense of humor and shares your politics. I think he'd make a great guest. He's also very generous with his time and has appeared on dozens of podcasts. There's a second part to this question, but I think it's about something else, Will. So, Todd McGowan, your thoughts. I'm pro.
Well, you've stumped the buff because I actually don't have any of his books, but I know you have the Lynch one. So, should I?
You don't have his David Lynch book?
No, I don't.
Really good.
No.
If people want to read a good Todd McGowan essay, there's a great essay in that book about Fire Walk With Me that I think is some of the best analysis of David Lynch that I've ever read. I mean, it blows David Foster Wallace away, I'm sorry to say. Although that long kind of novella length essay he wrote does have some genuinely good insights into Lynch. But if you're interested in David Lynch, you can't go wrong with Todd McGowan's book about him. Also, I didn't really know sort of the context for Todd McGowan. So if he's a fellow podcaster and he shares our politics and he's goes on podcasts, I don't know, Will. Maybe we should have Todd McGowan on. It seems like a good idea. So Matthew also says, also it's a TV show and so is Studio 60, but would you be interested in talking about Trailer Park Boys? Such a great show, and I think it would resonate with many American fans from the Northeast and Appalachia, as anyone who's familiar with those areas will immediately recognize continuity with the Trailer Park Boys environment. Thanks. Will, I have thoughts on Trailer Park Boys, but do you have a relationship with them?
No, none at all, which is shameful as a Canadian.
You haven't seen the Trailer Park Boys?
I've seen it, but I have no relationship with it.
Anyone who thinks that public arts funding can't yield good TV programs, I believe it's probably like the federal government through the Canada Council and also the Nova Scotia Arts Council. I think both put money into making Trailer Park Boys happen. And I think it's great. I mean, I think it's like one of the funniest, most sensitive shows of its kind. I think I've only maybe seen the first 2.5 seasons in continuous order, but I've seen other episodes sporadically and a few of the movie tie-ins and things like that. I think the Trailer Park Boys are very funny, and they would definitely be worthy of a treatment. If you're a non-Canadian listening to this and you don't know the Trailer Park Boys, it is just like a super fun show. Like, you know, if you're looking to scratch an itch that's kind of like, I don't know, The Office or something, but in many ways more interesting, check out Trailer Park Boys.
And finally, we have one more question again from Eric the Bed Humper. His second ass-related question of the evening, I have to say. I don't know what's going on there. But he asks what we think of Vince McMahon's Kiss My Ass Club. Now, not everyone may know about this. I know what this is. I'm quoting directly here from the Pro Wrestling Wiki. It says, the Kiss My Ass Club consisted of members who were ordered by Vince McMahon, remember, that's the president of the WWE, to show their respect and loyalty towards him by having to kiss his butt. Many of the times, these members were threatened with receiving a suspension or being fired if they refused. The Rock attempted, that's Dwayne The Rock Johnson, folks, attempted to close the club after an episode of SmackDown where Vince McMahon was forced to kiss the ass of Rikishi. However, this attempt to close the club was not successful. Okay, we're getting into deep lore here. Point is, it was the thing that Vince McMahon would do where he would make people kiss his ass in the ring. I don't know. Seems like a toxic workplace environment, in my opinion. I do not approve of that. And I think Vince McMahon, by all accounts, seems like a pretty bad person.
Didn't he just have to like resign or something? Like,
I'm only learning this. I don't follow Vince McMahon too closely. I kind of have him filed away in my brain in the I get that file. But I'm reading from Wikipedia here. Vince McMahon resigned in January 2024 after allegations of sex trafficking and sexual assault. McMahon is currently under a federal probe. So what do I think of this Kiss My Ass Club that he had? I think this is a manifestation of, you know, a man who likes power in a very unhealthy way.
Well, folks, as always, thank you for your questions. I promise we won't get the next one of these to you quite so late. In
Big
fact,
words.
Maybe we will post post a thread for you to ask the June questions soon, and you know, get to that maybe next week or the one following, but it won't be a month from now. I promise. And yeah, as always, that was fun. Thanks for your questions.
Now watch this drive.